Hello, and welcome to NWR Connectivity, episode 323. I'm Neil Ronahan, back after a week out in the wilderness. I was on like a work trip, went to the greater outer reaches of New York City. But now I'm back, and I'm with John Reardon.
Howdy, everybody.
And we are here to talk about all of the new latest games. So let's start. Let's hit the ground running. We've got so much to cover. John, let's talk about Dante's Inferno.
Yes, Dante's Inferno, a popular current game for current gen systems, for current gen boys and girls.
Before you hang up, we're going to talk about E3 2002 later. So from the Nintendo perspective, so stick around for that.
No, so I didn't expect to be talking about Dante's Inferno, but this afternoon, well, this evening, I keep saying this afternoon, I said that when I was talking to Neil beforehand, also, time is an illusion. I was looking for something to play that I could play in a brain-dead way until Neil got here to record the podcast. So I went on Game Pass and was looking for something that was very small to download, which is usually an Xbox 360 game, because they're all like a couple gigs. And I saw Dante's Inferno, and I remember that game being kind of okay. So I downloaded it. And boy, what a time this game was from. I was talking to my wife about it, and I was trying to describe. So this game and Darksiders are kind of like a similar like era.
They're contemporary. Dante's Inferno 2010 came out on PS3 and Xbox. And yeah, if you are curious, it's on Game Pass.
Yes, play it in 4K. Well, the HUD is like at 720, but parts of it are in 4K. But I was talking to my wife about it, and it was this weird era where it was like the dude broification of classical literature, with Dante's Inferno, of course, being Dante's Inferno, and like Darksiders being the Bible. And so it was taking this stuff and being like, that won't appeal to the dude in their backwards hats. We need to make this edgier. So like, add boobs, and maybe Dante is a Knights Templar who starts off by murdering the Grim Reaper so that he won't die. Like, and it's so, and if you haven't read Dante's Inferno, that part doesn't happen. Dante's Inferno, the book, which is a great read, surprisingly fun, is essentially, it's like Alice in Wonderland. Like, it doesn't really have much of a plot in the book itself. It's kind of just a tour where they describe a bunch of places, and it's enjoyable because it's very well written. And the game went in and added, you know, a plot, and you're like a Knights Templar coming home from the Crusades, and Satan is mad at you because like you murdered the Grim Reaper, which like fair. And so he takes your wife. And so you, with the Grim Reaper's scythe that you took off of his cold, lifeless corpse, go into hell to go beat the shit out of Satan to get your wife back, which is the best interpretation of classical literature on the planet. And I'm playing it, and my wife is like who looked at Dante's Inferno and was like, this would be a great video game? And I had to be like, well, I think what they did is looked across the table at Sony on PS3 making God of War games and went, you know, there's openings for more games like this, especially on Xbox, where God of War isn't. What other mythologies can we pillage? And they were like, how about Christianity? And so they did that.
It was that era that I guess God of War would probably be the earliest point of it, of just those character action games that were like gloriously over the top, usually referencing some kind of mythology or history or religion. Yeah. I mean, Bayonetta's one that always kind of felt like of that era with Dante's Inferno as well. Obviously, I think Bayonetta has aged better because it took a more unique witchcraft approach as opposed to like, we're taking Dante Alighieri's Layers of Hell.
Yeah, Bayonetta is a bit more like, it still has a bunch of like Christian theology in it, but it's a bit vaguer with it and like isn't so direct. And it's also just a better game.
So I alluded to you before the show about my Dante's Inferno stories. So this would have been like 2009. Yeah, this came out in 2010, but like that era was probably the peak of me, you know, young boy journalist going to every video game event I could. I went to my first E3 in 2009, which I think Dante's Inferno might have been at. I think it came out in early 2010. So if it was at an E3, it would have been at 09. But I remember I went to a small convention in Philadelphia that I don't think was Too Many Games, but was in the same space as Too Many Games, which is now a convention that I think has been going on for like a decade. we've had panels there in the past. It's a pretty cool convention. I haven't gone in a couple of years for obvious reasons, but even before COVID, I haven't gone in a little while. But I remember it was my first time going to like this convention in this area, like in the greater Philadelphia area, walking in, and they had this huge Dante's Inferno booth right near the front, EA, you know, ready to show it off. And my wife and I are just like looking around, and like we see this booth, and there's just like a child staring at someone fighting the boss with boobs.
Yeah.
the one where just like monsters come out of her nipples. And it yep. was just like this was like a 6 year old at best, just
yes.
enraptured by this. As like we just stared like slack-jawed, being like, how did anyone think this was a good idea? It was like the minute you walked in. It's just,
yeah,
here's the demo level.
You can like see it from the street.
Yeah, the boob demon. But that's my Dante's Inferno story. Also, like, no, I remember it being a pretty fun character action game. Like, be average at best.
I like it better than the God of War games of that era.
Yeah, because I think God of War 1 and 2, if I remember, are pretty solid. And I haven't liked a God of War game since.
Now, granted, I didn't play the PS2 God of War games until fairly recently. I think God of War 1 especially has aged like cheese. I think that game just plays horribly.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'll also point out, I played God of War 1 in like 2005 when I was of the age where
yeah.
like hardcore sex on a boat with people yeah. to heal health
to
funny.
A quick time event.
Meanwhile, the dude who worked on that game is just like, I don't know, I can't shoot upwards.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. That's the other reason Dante's Inferno is better. It allows you to have things slightly above the player. There are enemies in Dante's Inferno that you have to jump up to hit. And I don't think that guy could have handled that. But speaking of QuickTime events, Dante's Inferno, and I don't remember if God of War does this, it has a QuickTime event for interacting with the thing that gives you health and magic. Like there are these little pools that you have to like you click on to like get your health back. And there's a QuickTime event to get your help. Like, just let me click on it. And it's the weird, like, just everything is a QuickTime event in this era. And I'm trying to do it as a Nintendo fan playing on an Xbox controller, so none of the buttons are in the right place. So QuickTime events are just the bane of my existence. But yeah, it's a good game. The funny thing is that despite it adding an entirely original plot and being so ludicrous compared to the actual book upon which it's based, it's simultaneously like totally accurate to the book, because like all it does is add extra things on top. But like all of like the areas that you go through are very accurate to how they're described. And like most of Virgil's dialogue, like your guide throughout the game, he's just giving his dialogue from the book. So it's like crazy accurate despite being so stupid. And I love that.
We need to have more like hardcore takes of like classic literature.
This was supposed to be a series. They were planning to do the whole Divine Comedy, but they like this ends on a cliffhanger, but they did not, which is weird because I thought this game did OK. Maybe it didn't do as well as I think it
might
did.
Have. It might have been the kind. I mean, they had all this money to send this booth to a random convention in outside Philadelphia.
I'll bet that 6 year old bought it.
Yeah, no, it's 6 year old. I mean, now that 6 year old's 25, so it's actually Xander now.
Yeah.
I might be one of those games like how we make fun of Square Enix for being like Tomb Raider sold 6 million copies and did not meet projections. It could have been one of those games that like sold pretty well, but EA had higher hopes and it didn't hit them.
Weird that the classical literature didn't land quite like Call of Duty does.
You know, let's see, is there any sales data for this game?
You Google it and it just says why.
Oh my god, this is the thing where they had all the EA sent an unsolicited mailing in which checks for $200 were sent to select video game critics with the following note: in Dante's Inferno, greed is a two-headed beast. Hoarding wealth feeds one beast and squandering it satiates the other. By cashing the check, you succumb to avarice. By holding filthy lucre, but by not cashing it, you waste it and thereby surrender to prodigality. Make your choice and suffer the consequences for your sin, and scoff not, for consequences are imminent.
The fuck?
So that's my, yeah.
That's, you can't,
I think I actually wrote about that like in my PR class in college. I think I like wrote like use that as an example of like batshit insane PR tactics.
Yeah. Like, is that you can't do that, guys. Nobody along the way was like, do you think this could be seen poorly?
On September 9th, 2009, GameStop offered a Number of the Beast pre-order where you were offered a $6.66 discount if you pre-ordered on that day.
This is a weird game because it does this weird thing where it appealed both to like, yeah, Satan and demons, but like also my Christian high school literature teacher was into it because it was Dante's Inferno. Like it was this weird, like it, like half the people in line are like good Christian moms in their denim skirts. And then the other half are like goth kids in metal t-shirts. It gets a beautiful smattering of cultures.
Yeah. So there was also, here's another thing, hot Dante's Inferno stories. I forgot that at E3 2009, there were a bunch of protesters protesting the game, and it turned out that they were all paid to be there by EA as a marketing stunt.
Nice. Yeah, nobody cares.
Can't find anything about the sales.
It sounds like they spent if you're mailing off $200 checks to a bunch of people, you quickly spend a lot of money on your game.
Burning through money.
Yeah, so it would have had to sell crazy to make up for all the actors they hired and checks they mailed off, and that kid's therapy that he would need after seeing the boob demon at 6 years old. Kid is probably still getting paychecks from EA every month.
So in newer games that are somehow older than a 12-year-old game, I got my Playdate last week.
Woo!
So for people who don't know, it's this bizarre yellow system that has a crank on the side, and the screen is monochromatic, and it is the most hipster thing that I own. But so the way Playdate works for people who don't know is that like you buy the system and you also then, I guess, subscribe to season one, which there are 24 games in season one. You get two of them a week. So far I'm in week two, so I have four games. You can also sideload games onto it very easily. So like I've been getting some things on Itch. There's a good Picross game that I have on my Playdate now. And there's some cool indie stuff out there. I haven't really dug into the one that I think is probably like the fullest release called Bloom, which is, it's like a game that you're basically, you know, building a garden, but then there's this whole like texting component in it. And it's like an incremental game that progresses more as you play each day. But so far, the four games that I have, two have kind of stood out to me, and they're two which are part of the reason why I got this silly little system, which is Whitewater Wipeout from our friends at Chuhai Labs. And so that game is extremely simple. It is, you are on a wave, you turn the crank of the system to start to move your surfer down onto the wave, and you have to like feather the crank to go up and down in the wave to cruise speed, and you go up into the air and you have to spin it really fast to do spins. And then it's a high score game.
Feather the crank might be one of my favorite descriptions of a control scheme ever.
And then you have to spin it real fast, you know, feather that crank, you know. But it's really hard, but it's just a really good high score game. I'm definitely not that good at it. I can look at like the online leaderboards, because also, by the way, this little like this little device that looks like it's from 1986 is also connected to the internet and will like automatically download new games every week. That's what it is that you get two games when you first turn it on. And then so like my new games day is Monday, because that's when I got mine in the mail. So now for the next 12 weeks, every Monday, I'm going to have two new games downloaded to my system.
Does it replace the old ones, or does it just add to a library?
So there is a limited amount of space, but because the games are all teeny tiny, I think there's sure. Like, I think there's like a couple gigs on there, and like I'm not close to filling it. And I have like there's like a Yahtzee game that I have on there. What else do I have? Oh, there's a Tetris game on there too. That just felt like a nice thing to have on a little handheld. But yeah, Whitewater Wipeout, super cool, good vibes, like exactly what I expected. The other one that is I only got a couple days ago is Kranken's Time Adventure, which is by Kenta Takahashi, the Katamari guy. And after he, you know, got out of, he, did you hear anything about the Annapurna, or no, it wasn't Annapurna, phenomena, the fallout of that company?
Was that where he made the
yeah, he made the Ford game? Of chairs, so that way it would separate him from the head of the company who
yes, like, I do remember hearing everybody. About that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he escaped his chair fort and made Krankens Time Adventure, which is a really like weird little game. So the concept of it is that you are this robot named Kranken, that it wakes up late for a date with his like Krankette, I think might literally be the character's name. And then you have to turn the crank very fast to try to get there as soon as you can to the date. You're always late, no matter what. And every level, like initially, it's just kind of like you just crank fast and you get there. But then it'll have like, oh, like when there's a flower, you automatically stop to smell it. When there's a hurdle, you hop over the hurdle. And then there will be obstacles that show up. Like there's like a butterfly that will float in the air. So you'll have to like time it with the crank to, you know, go real fast until you get to the flower or bending down, then stay bent down, let the butterfly go over you so it doesn't hit you and like knock you out. And every like I think there's 50 levels. I'm in the teens somewhere. It's a lot of trial and error, but it's just like a really clever little puzzle game that makes a really good use of the crank of the system. And because sometimes it is just like, all right, just go as fast as you can, like try to artfully like dodge out of the way of these butterflies coming at you. Oh no, there's a shitload of pigs coming. Like, what do I do? And yeah, it's a really cute puzzle game. The other two games, one is like a top down sprite based Pokemon Snap kind of game called Casual Birder. That I spent a little time of with, like, it seems a little bit, I don't want to say inconsequential, but like it seems like it's just kind of like you go around and you talk to people and take pictures of birds using the crank to get them in focus. Like that's it seems fine. I am excited for I know there's a game from Vertex Pop and Zach Gage coming later in the season. And I think the guy who did Lucas Pope, the guy who did what the hell is the name of that game? Return of the Obra Dinn. Apparently he's working on a game for it as well. And I now like I've paid attention to the Reddit a little bit more. Somebody's talked about making a Rhythm Heaven like game for it, which would be perfect. And I think the indie scene for this thing is going to be fun because it's going to be like that just kind of lo-fi experimental vibe. I think there's people like working. It's like an early access Pokemon game for it. It's just really neat. And I haven't dug into any of the development tools that they have, which are supposedly very intuitive to do. I mean, like you can kind of do basic visual novel stuff very easily. And people are starting to like play with it more and do more interesting things with it. I'm just curious to see where it goes. Happy to be experiencing all these games. And I feel like the best way to summarize it is exactly what I expected, which is at the end of the day, a little bit disappointing, but it's what I wanted. Like, I didn't expect this to be some polished system that I played all the time. I expected it to be like this goofy little toy that I checked out a couple times a week. And it satisfied that.
I'm already seeing, just kind of looking at like indie stuff going on it, like the side loading stuff. It looks like there's already a Game Boy emulator either running on it or in development for it.
Yeah, no, I mean, because it also has, I did mention the crank most prominently, but it has a D-pad and two buttons as well.
Yeah, so perfect for
you could easily, I might have to have a waking dream and mess around with that, because it sounds like a good thing to do.
I hope the crank like adjusts the contrast or something, though. Like I want the crank to do something in the emulator.
I do get bummed out when I do find a game and it, like there's a Yahtzee game that I was like, oh, I get to like, oh, no, I just press a button. But some of that is because the systems are still like I was in group one and I didn't get mine mailed out until like a month after it started being shipped out to people.
Yeah, I know they recently announced that like they're through what they can do this year as far as orders go.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So, I mean, it's like hard to get a hand on, but also people haven't really been able to. It's been a lot of like, I guess, like development without actually testing it on the system.
Sure,
because I think they released the like Pulp is like their development tool, and I think it's all like Lewis scripts and stuff too, but I think they released that to the public. You can design a game on your browser on your computer, So now that people actually have their hands on the system, they can start to tinker with it more.
Yeah, you should be required to use the crank.
But anyway, let's go to some listener mail, and then we'll talk, go into our feature topic. So this one comes from our good old fam, James T. Tiberius Kirk. Good morning, gentlemen. Hope all is well. I was wondering if you were going to read Reggie's book. I just got it in the mail. If so, let us know what you think of it on the show. So, John, you are listening to Reggie kick your ass and take your name.
Yeah, it's like Reggie is in the car with me on my drive to work, telling me stories that like are probably 70% true.
And I read through Reggie's book, Disrupting the Game, before he just started kind of putting his, I don't know, putting his head into everything. Amidst while the company that he used to run is just like, shit's been terrible for 20 years. This dude came in and didn't save it. And he's like, I had nothing to do with that. It's not the Nintendo I knew.
Which, I mean, fair. It's you're trying to release a book and this PR stuff is getting in your way. Yeah.
Yeah. But I found Reggie's book interesting, and especially kind of contrasting it with Satoru Iwata's, or the Satoru Iwata book that came out. Because even though a lot of it was his words kind of, you know, translated and put together, that wasn't so much like this is Reggie's book. The other one was, it was the Satoru Iwata book, not like Satoru Iwata's book. But from a business perspective, like they kind of were going for the same goals of like, hey, like, this is a person who is a manager, you know, leader of a big company. What are their, Reggie's whole thing is that he talks about, here's the so what, which really like comes off tone deaf in his book, because he starts it off on a real emotional note talking about.
Oh, the first chapter is really like, whoa.
It's emotional and gut-wrenching because it's Reggie talking about Satoru Iwata's death and how close his relationship with was it. And he's writing a business advice book. So it's just that, like, here's the time I got one over the dead guy. Here's the so what about my dead colleague. And that stuff came off really weird. Even though, like, when he is talking about Iwata, like, it is very reverent, respectful. Like, yes. I don't think
he doesn't mean for it to come off that way.
It's just it's the style of the book, and the fact that he's talking about such like a delicate emotional topic is kind of wild.
Yeah, I kind of wish it wasn't so much of a business advice book and more of just a anecdote.
Tell me stories, buddy.
Story, because that's the when he's just telling stories, like, some of them you question the facts, but like, I mean, it's it's autobiographical. Like, that's you're always going to have to take it with a grain of salt. But when he's just telling a story, that is the best part of the book. It's once he starts trying to tell me how to use it in a way that isn't applicable, that it kind of falls apart.
Yeah. And it's not, I mean, it's not, I don't think there's like terrible advice in that book at all. And I mean, what I found most interesting, and I mean, definitely the Nintendo dirt, which there's not like a ton of dirt in there, but there's definitely some interesting tidbits and just kind of gives you a different perspective to his tenure at Nintendo. And I do, it is the kind of thing where like he's a marketing guy. And I think it's with any kind of book like this from a marketing guy, take it with a grain of salt. That's my two cents and my recommendations. There are definitely things that I read that Reggie said were true that I have heard the contrary from. But I also found it interesting, his background, because, you know, it's been like a month or two since I read the book, so I don't remember exactly the specifics of, but what, he grew up in the Bronx, like, kind of wasn't a super rich kid, and then how he kind of rose to the ranks at his different jobs, his time at Pizza Hut. I thought his time at VH1 was really interesting. I know, John, you haven't gotten there yet, but
it's a slow burn.
Yeah, his experience, like, I mean, it's he started at VH1 right before September 11th, and that building is in New York City. Connect the dots, and dude's lived an interesting life. He's had an interesting career.
Yeah, that's kind of why I wish it was almost more of just a traditional biography.
Yeah.
Like, I read that, you know, maybe not written by him.
And I understand why it's like this. But what kind of bugged me, as someone who lived through most of his tenure, or, you know, as a reporter for most of his tenure running Nintendo, I think, when was he named president? I might have covered the entire time, but he focuses on his wins, which I understand why you would do that. But like, it is just like, look at how great I was with launching the Wii and the DS. And then just kind of like, there's just like Wii U. And then the Switch came out. He like does not give time to let the learning experiences from some of the losses breathe. Because that's something that like I would want to know is, hey man, like you blocked the release of Mother 3. You blocked the release of the project, Operation Rainfall games. You didn't think Xenoblade should come out in America. Like, why? Disaster Day of Crisis. I would have liked to play that in North America. It's available in like literally every other region. What gives, dude?
Yeah.
And that's like, I'm like, it is the kind of thing where like I'm kind of in here being like, you know, shining the spotlight on him, being like, tell me. But really, I just think it would be interesting because he does have a business justification for that. That's why he did it. Tell us what that business justification is, because you can't just show us, here's all the times I was right when I like slapped Satoru Iwata's hand and told him that the 3DS was too expensive and it'll never work. Or you were like, oh, Wii Sports needs to be in a pack-in. Like, you can't have everything you touch turn to gold, man. And we saw it play out live. Like, tell us where you fell short.
Yeah, and some of the stuff that there, when he did have a win, like, you then question how much of it was him. Like, if you do compare this to the Ask Iwata book, there's a noticeable difference in
humility.
Iwata constantly being like, here's this awesome thing that this other person did, and I learned a lot from that. Whereas Reggie, his book tends to be more, here's an awesome thing that I did, and here's what you can learn from it.
And I think, and I don't know if you've gotten to it yet, I forget, it's one of his early things, he does kind of harp on a failure that he made, but it's very much from the, like, I was a 24-year-old. Like,
yes. It's very much from the perspective of, well, and it's not a complete failure because the thing he did worked.
Yeah,
it's that he didn't do the thing that worked the right way. So it's a humble brag.
Like, yeah. Yep.
It's because he made some decision for a marketing thing that totally worked, but he didn't go through the right channels and that was bad. So it's not even a, like, I made a huge mistake. It's framed as if it's this huge problem, but it's not, because ultimately he still comes around to like, yeah, and it still worked, but you know, I probably should have asked this person.
Yeah.
So it doesn't ring quite the same.
But I think if you're definitely that ilk of a Nintendo fan, like, dude, just read the book.
Oh,
you'll,
yeah.
You'll and get something from
it. And there's so much, like, if you can read through the bullshit, there's a lot of good in there. And a lot of his stories are genuinely interesting. Like, especially, I mean, honestly, like, the stuff outside of Nintendo.
The
like
Pizza Hut stuff is fun.
Pizza stuff. And I, like, all the stuff of when he was a kid, like, they're really fascinating stories.
And I really want to know, did he actually play that many video games? That is the myth. That, like, because I know everybody always dunked on him because he'd be like, I played 150 hours of Dragon Quest IX, and nobody believed him. Like, I just hooked that man up to a lie detector. I want to know.
Wouldn't work. It's not admissible in court.
So let's move on to talking about E3 2002, which was a time in which I think Reggie would have been working at VH1. He was not yet at Nintendo, still a couple years away. I think he started 2004.
Maybe 2003.
Yeah, it might have been. I think E3 2004 was his first like public showing, but he might have been around in 2003.
Okay, yeah.
To give you a preview to look ahead, there's like he talks a lot about the guy who basically was like came up with the idea of his portrayal at E3. That's what I want to know more about how Nintendo like determined their presentations at E3, because I think there is that balance between Japan and America with those that like that would be the feature that's the story I want Reggie to go deep into. And he definitely does some of it, because he does talk about the planning of E3. It's good stuff. But E3 2002, Reggie-less E3. But this is fascinating. John and I both watched the press conference that's available at Nintendo World Report TV. We should remember to include a link or just embed it on the article for the podcast.
That's what we'll do.
We will
you
not
people
remember
listening
this.
On Spotify are kind of screwed, but go to NintendoWorldReport.com and then follow a link to our YouTube channel. It's roundabout, but you'll get there.
But so this press conference was almost, well, I guess probably by the time you listen to this, it'll be precariously close to 20 years to the day. It was May 21st, 2002. And it was 3 days before Satoru Iwata was named president of Nintendo as Hiroshi Yamashi retired at age 75, I think. But Satoru Iwata is very much like a co-host of this presentation, along with Peter McDougall, who was the executive vice president of sales and marketing for NOA, which I think might have been the title that Reggie walked into when he first
that
joined
sounds
the company.
Right.
But they were basically the two hosts of this presentation, and Iwata at that point was just kind of like an exec at Nintendo. And by the time this E3 was over, he was president of the company.
It went really well. They were just, this E3 is going great. We're going to promote you.
And actually, I think Iwata had been, I think he did the E3 2001 press conference too.
I think so.
So he was starting to get more FaceTime. And I think kind of as the story goes, is that he was earmarked to be the successor when he moved over to Nintendo from HAL in 2000. But Nintendo started this off saying that they thought that they had the finest lineup of games at an E3 ever, which, I mean, it is a really good lineup, but it's also hilarious in context because Sony at this E3, I think their press conference was first, and they declared the console wars over because they had sold over 30 million PS2 systems, which is factually true because neither Xbox nor GameCube passed 30 million sales. So yeah, I mean, Sony definitely won this war, but it is Nintendo coming out, and I mean, they did have a very good lineup, and I think it was better than Sony and Microsoft's.
It's better than most. I mean, this is probably one of the best years Nintendo's had for an E3 lineup. Like, it's all of your favorite GameCube games are here, and some of your not as favorite.
I mean, this was like the start of a very good run for the GameCube. You could arguably say it was the only good run. I mean, I think GameCube's near and dear to my heart, but like kind of taking off my rose-colored glasses, I still think the launch is very strong.
Yep. The first couple years are good.
Well, I guess couple meaning two.
This would be year two, right? Yeah. So
year two was strong because 2001 you had Pikmin, Luigi's Mansion, Melee, Rogue Leader, like solid third party support. And then there was kind of a big gap, which is a common trend for most Nintendo consoles in their first most consoles, period. Honestly.
Yeah, we're in it right now with the Xbox and PS5.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been years. But that's, you know, unprecedented times.
Yes.
But we were about to come up on a lineup where. Like you look at Nintendo's press release and it is just like, we're going to have something every month. There's Super Mario Sunshine in August. There's Star Fox Adventures in September. Animal Crossing is coming out. That was kind of the big new game was Animal Crossing coming out that fall. Metroid Prime hitting in November. Wind Waker coming in. Oh, it's weird. This still isn't called Wind Waker yet. It's just The Legend of Zelda.
It's just Zelda. Yep.
And that was coming out in February of 2003. You even had Eternal Darkness, a first-party game, coming out the next month in June. It is a strong lineup. They started off with Metroid Prime as kind of the press conference opener. We had known what Metroid Prime was before then, but this was really, I think, the first time it was playable.
And this might have been the first like extensive trailer for it. I think we'd seen teases of it like in sizzle reels, but I think this was the first time that it had a long trailer and a pretty good trailer, honestly. And this was also, they really leaned into at the beginning of this press conference. They started with Metroid and they were leaning into this narrative of like, we have games for grownups, like mature audiences. So that was like Metroid and Resident Evil and Eternal Darkness were their mature games.
Yeah, and I did like this tidbit that I looked from looking at the news at our fine site, because we were playing at GameCube back in the day, where Johnny Metz actually asked this question to Shigeru Miyamoto during a dev roundtable at E3 about his specific involvement with Metroid Prime. And Miyamoto described his level of involvement with the game as being, quote, very high. And he said that three of the people at Nintendo EAD were basically working every single day on Metroid Prime. calling them half directors. And I think that's something that at the time we didn't really know how a lot of that worked. But it's something that's always worth pointing out with a lot of these internal Nintendo projects that are then like developed by Next Level or Retro or Mercury Steam. If you can't tell, I'm on a little bit of a Metroid slant with this. Mm-hmm. But with all those, there's always people in Nintendo that are almost just as hands-on as the core development teams.
Well, and especially Metroid Prime, which was notoriously poorly managed by Retro Studios.
Yeah.
Like the development of that game wasn't smooth, so even if it wasn't the norm, you'd probably have, like, let's put Miyamoto in charge of it.
Did you read Brian Walker, the interview that was on Shang Sparkers recently, who was a guy who came on to the team in the development of Metroid Prime 2, and then, like, was kind of, I think he was, like, kind of a head developer and left after Donkey Kong Country Returns? Brian Walker, I think is the guy's name.
I don't know. I'm trying to remember. Most of my Metroid Prime knowledge is left over from the developers for it. So I don't remember talking about him.
But he did. He came on to the development team, Retro Studios, for Metroid Prime 2, but just like talked about how like there was just such like everybody was so tired after the first Metroid Prime. Just like that. Like they were proud of the work and everything, but like it was just everybody was so beaten down coming into Prime 2.
Yeah, and they had gone through like multiple like changes in leadership, and like it was a mess. Did Kelbot take over partway through Prime?
Maybe.
Or was that not until Prime 2? I think that might have been part. Like there were tons of shakeups during the development of that game. Kelbot I think took over for Metro Prime 2, and it was there was a guy between Kelbot
since 2003. So yeah, because Kelbot was just at. I think he was at MST.
He was a game tester.
Yeah, yeah.
And he took over for, I can't think of the name of the guy that took over for the guy who was running
Steve
a porn site.
Barcia, who was the president after Spangenberg was fired.
Yes, that's who I'm thinking of. Yeah, so I think he went through most of Prime, and then Kelbot took over for Prime 2.
Yeah.
And I think Kelbot's still,
I believe he's still the president.
Yeah.
Let's go to his LinkedIn, because that came up when I searched his name.
I'm pretty sure he's still there. I feel like we would have heard if he left.
Yeah, still president and CEO of Retro Studios.
Yeah.
He's been there for almost 20 years. So there are some interesting things. And once again, go over to NintendoWorldReport.com, look at our extensive E3 2002 coverage. It was kind of weird reading Johnny Metz's hands-on preview of Metroid Prime, especially like having spent most of my time talking to him over the years about how much he loves this freaking game. That like this is the first time he ever touched it, and definitely from the perspective of his hands on, like this was assuredly the first time it was playable. He talks about how he wasn't sure if Samus would even be able to jump in this game, but it is like it seems like it was very instant in people playing this game. There was only one demo level there. I think it was just the opening part, because then it ends on the Parasite Queen. I think it's just that opening area. But yeah, like it seemed very instant that the game just clicked and felt right.
Another Nintendo World Report plug. You can check out Johnny Metz's original review in video form on our YouTube channel. Vintage review. Yeah.
Yep.
Just go to our channel. Watch all the things.
Yeah, Metroid Prime. Man, I can't wait for more Metroid Prime.
That's a good idea. Someone should make more of them.
They should do that.
Give me the old ones in HD. I'll take that too.
And we shouldn't think too hard about the fact that the gap between Metroid Prime and the original Metroid is likely going to be the same gap between Metroid Prime 3 and Metroid Prime 4.
Well, no, they got rid of that because they made Metroid Prime Federation Force. So
that's not how it works.
We're good now.
Okay, sure.
That's the real Metroid Prime 4. We're moving on to 5.
So with that, like Nintendo being hardcore, because this is during the period where everybody called them kitty for their cartoon games. They also highlighted Resident Evil Zero, which was coming out soon, and Eternal Darkness, which was a few weeks away from release. Then we got a Game Boy Advance run, which Metroid Fusion was named for the first time. It was known before as Metroid 4. And this is the first time it was really shown off. Mike Sklenz, former Nintendo World Report staffer, he had some hands-on from it, and it's like one of those things where it's like it feels like 2D Metroid, and I think the demo was relatively short comparatively to some other things. The big reveal here was The Legend of Zelda Link to the Past coming to Game Boy Advance, which yes. I think this was the first reveal of that. I think we might have known that there was a Zelda project on GBA, just not what it was.
I do think it's interesting that they show this as just Link to the Past. They show parts of Four Swords in there, like in that trailer, but don't acknowledge that it's anything yeah. other than Link to the Past,
yeah.
which seems weird.
Yeah, so, I mean, that kind of connects to a later part where after they show Wind Waker, Miyamoto's just like, oh, we got more Zelda to show. And it seemed like everybody expected it to be, you know, a realistic Zelda, but then it's just four-player GBA Super Nintendo.
So, yeah.
For the next part after the GBA run is Iwata comes out, and this is the first time he's really out for this this event. He was there for the opener. He's talking at more length. He's talking about online connectivity and just connectivity in general. But John, you pointed out the fact that like he almost kind of rants about how he's like, I don't think online is there.
Yeah.
Also rich because this is the E3 that like Battlefield 1942 became the biggest deal.
he comes out and he's like, you're going to be hearing a lot about online. And he kind of phrases it as like, that's certainly something that like maybe one day will be there. But he really puts it in this position of like, most people aren't in a situation to do that. So it's not really something we're worried about. Also, we did it first on the Famicom. So like, who even cares? Also, here's an online game for the GameCube, even though I kind of said, who cares?
Yeah, no licensing fees. Yeah, how do you reach all gamers? How costly is this all?
He's like, listen, this doesn't seem worth it. Is really the impression that I got from what he was saying
in 2002.
Probably not.
Wrong. He's not wrong.
I won't lie. My PS2 was hooked up to the internet, but my GameCube certainly wasn't.
Yeah. Xbox, when I got an Xbox, it was because I definitely played some Halo 2 online. And then talks about Phantasy Star Online and then is now, you know, the big thing about GBA GameCube connectivity is Animal Crossing, which there was, I think, some teasing before this E3 about like a big new game from Nintendo. And it was Animal Crossing,
which is funny because it's an N64 game.
Yeah, it was Animal. I think it might have been known by the hardcore circles as this weird experimental game called Animal Forest on the N64. Yeah. But I do love the way they pitch Animal Crossing, where it's like this skit with children. And I mean, it is the kind of thing. Guess what? Like the GBA to GameCube connectivity, super cool.
Yeah.
And it did portend the fact that Animal Crossing it's now one of Nintendo's core franchises, and it took a decade and then took longer to become the behemoth that it was because of COVID. But yeah, I mean, like, that's, you talk about the world not being ready for online. I don't think the world was really ready for Animal Crossing.
No. Once again, this was a crazy E3 for game lineup. Like, there's so many, like, you have stuff like Metroid Prime and like Animal Crossing where it's like, you people don't know what game you're about to play, and it's going to be crazy, and it's going to be beloved forever.
Yeah, and then there's Iwata reveals the Game Eye, which, I'll be real, I forgot about this. Do you even remember this, John?
I'll be honest, I don't remember this from the presentation that I watched earlier today.
So it's very subtly mentioned about the Game Eye as being basically a peripheral that you put into your Game Boy Advance that would, it was essentially a Game Boy camera. I will dramatically read, Daniel Bloodworth of Easy Allies fame, his impressions from E3 2002 of the Game Eye. The Game Eye plugs right into the cartridge slot of the GBA, but it looks very different from the old Game Boy camera. The pack extends above the GBA and has a horizontal bar about the size of a cigar. On the left end is a very small lens that captures the image. The right side has a dial that allows you to adjust the angle of the camera. You can face it towards you or away from you or at several angles in between. Anyone that used the Game Boy camera should be familiar with the software setup. You can see a full-color moving image on the screen and push a button to snap a shot that's saved to memory. You can also use L and R to zoom the camera, which is very nice. If the GBA is connected to the GameCube, you can then plant your face or whatever you took a picture of right into the game. At this time, Stage Debut is the only game being shown, but the technology is very nice. What's wild about that is that Stage Debut was shown at the C3 and then never came out.
If I were his editor, I wouldn't have let him say very nice twice so close together.
Yeah.
So you should go back, log back into your account and fix that when you're free, Daniel. Thank you. I'm going to be honest. Did this product come out? Like, did this happen? Is this some weird like Berenstain Bears shit? And like, is this a product that existed?
I don't know when it was. I didn't know when it was even like canceled. But like, it's also a thing that's like not very easy to Google.
Eye of the Beholder came out on Game Boy Advance. That's what came up when I searched for Game Eye.
Yeah, no, when I search, yeah. If you also look for Game Eye, it's a
unreleased accessory for Game Boy Advance. Yeah. Okay. So I'm not crazy in thinking that this does not exist.
Yeah, cool. Like we have no screens.
Yeah, but I do know that Eye of the Beholder came out on Game Boy Advance now, so that's neat. I learned a thing.
Yeah, and yeah, the Game Eye. It's wild. Yeah, that never came out, but that's something that like just blew my mind. Like I did not, and I've watched this press conference like before, and I feel like this did not stand out, but. Anyway, there was more GameCube footage shit after that. We got some Star Fox Adventures, Species Kick Buttus.
Yeah. What is this trailer?
Marketing in 2002. Weird. Weird.
The whole trailer is like a breakdown of like Fox McCloud's phylum. And it lists his species as Kick Buttus, which I'm going to say is canon. He is not a fox.
Officially from Nintendo.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Star Fox Adventures. It was pretty close to coming out. There was apparently a press conference Q&A in which someone asked if Nintendo was still going to, or if Rare was still going to make games exclusively with Nintendo, because a lot of buyout rumors were happening. And Nintendo's response was, of course, oh, yes. And that changed very quickly. I forget the exact date that the sale to Microsoft happened, but it was like maybe weeks or months after this. It was because it was before Star Fox Adventures came out.
Yeah.
That the sale was known.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then we got a compilation of other GameCube games, Mario Party 4, Magical Mirror starring Mickey Mouse, 1080 White Storm, which would later become 1080 Avalanche, Mario World. And then you get the little bit of the gamesmanship of Miyamoto is supposed to come out to show off Super Mario Sunshine. And he doesn't come out, but then somebody's playing a demo of Super Mario Sunshine. And then it is Miyamoto coming out from the audience, holding a wave bird, playing Super Mario Sunshine, which, you know what ruled? The wave bird. What a great controller.
Yeah. So when I was a kid, the layout of our house, we had kind of like a back porch, and then the house kind of wrapped around it. And so if you opened windows in the dining room and the family room, you could see through across the back porch and see the TV. And I, at one point, just to see if I could, played Wind Waker from the dining room. Because I'm like, it's wireless.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
But hey, Sunshine, it's a game.
It's the best one.
But once again, it is very weird marketing because it's all this stuff about like, you know, Mario's taking a vacation.
Yeah, they say throw fireballs at him, laugh at his mustache, but do not mess with his vacation. God, I love the marketing babble of this period. It's
they
great.
They didn't know what to do.
It's so dumb.
Who
it's
are
wonderful.
They? Who is this for?
Right.
Then we had new Wind Waker footage, mention of 5 different levels playable. It was not known as Wind Waker yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then Miyamoto plays a demo and then there's a bug and it messes the demo up. It's funny.
It's like uncomfortable to watch because like you can see him slowly panic as he realizes that a sword he needed to break through a wall didn't spawn.
Yep.
Like
ready to murder someone, flip a tea table.
Yeah.
Enact Mario time.
It's something about Zelda demos.
Yeah, just cursed.
They do not work.
And then Miyamoto teases another Zelda, as we said before, but it's just 4 swords. But then he gets out Yoshiki Okamoto from Capcom, who Capcom was working on Link to the Past and Four Swords for Game Boy Advance. That would be, I think that was a flagship joint, and like one of the key members of flagship now is like the director of Breath of the Wild, Fujibayashi. Mm-hmm. Then Kaneto Shiozawa from Namco was out there, and Toshiro Nagoshi from Sega, who people might know now as the guy who made all the Yakuza games.
Yeah.
But they were there largely because that was when Nintendo was talking heavily about the Triforce arcade board, which was a joint project between them, Namco, and Sega. And John, I'll let you talk about the biggest missed thing of this E3.
Yeah, so this is one of the few, this, and there's like one other point, I don't remember where it was, where they briefly mention a Star Fox arcade game developed by Namco alongside Star Fox Assault. And so, yeah, like he brings up Shiozawa and he's like, he's in charge of Star Fox on arcade. And that's the extent of the mention here. That game never comes out. F-Zero, of course, does.
And F-Zero is 20 years ago was a halcyon time where F-Zero was like the surprise at the end of a press conference.
Right. Well, I think now it could be again. But
yeah,
they announced this game. It didn't come out. It was in development alongside Star Fox Assault. We know virtually nothing about it, but I know that Star Fox Assault had a kind of rough development time. So honestly, they may have just diverted all attention away from the arcade game and put it all into Star Fox Assault.
Yeah. And I think the Triforce arcade board really didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
And I was looking at, I actually found, we have it once again on NintendoWorldReport.com. We
what
have
a great website.
The old press release that Nintendo sent out from E3 2002. In it, I am 99% sure that F-Zero was never mentioned. So I would not be shocked if this is just like, oh, Nagoshi, you're going to be here. Can we put together a trailer for the F-Zero game that you're working on?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm trying to think, like, what even came out on... Oh, there was a lot more that came out on the arcade board than on the whatchamacallit.
Did the Mario Kart game run on that?
Yes.
Or was that different?
Yes, Mario Kart Arcade, GP, and GP2.
And you know what? That was Namco, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. That's what they did instead of Star Fox.
Yeah, so Namco, there's apparently two Donkey Kong ones that I think probably never made it out of Japan.
Was there a Luigi's Mansion one?
That was not a part of the Triforce.
Okay.
Then Sega did F-Zero, and then there's like some Virtua Strikers games that were a part of it as well.
Okay.
But yeah, so Namco did release things on the Triforce arcade board. It's the first two Mario Kart arcade games. But yeah, this is a really good E3, and it is like Nintendo, this whole theme of game giants that will drive retail sales. You know, Mario, Zelda, Metroid, and Fox. Two of these are not like the others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is a time where Nintendo was really pushing the fact that like Metroid and Star Fox were going to be huge things. And I think that's a reality that never really came to fruition. I mean, Metroid Dread is now the best-selling Metroid game of all time. It's been 6 months.
Yep. Well, and with not, like, in the grand scheme of game sales, it's the best-selling Metroid game without being that outrageous sales wise like the bar wasn't high. Like, it did well, but
3 million at this point. I think yeah. at the end of March 2022 was at 2.9 million.
Yeah. So it's like it's good, but like even compared to the rest of the Switch library, it's not amazing.
Yeah, it's not.
It's just
not
the bar for Metroid was so low. Yeah,
I think Ring Fit Adventure might have outsold every Metroid game combined,
probably.
If not, it's within the spitting distance, which is still very sobering when we look at how passionate we are about Metroid and how little it might ultimately matter.
Well, it's always the ones that sold the least that you feel like you need to be.
Yeah.
Nobody feels like they need to come to the defense of Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
But F-Zero, yeah, I gotta run in here and say that's great.
And Star Fox Adventures is a game that I think if Rare stuck around, maybe that becomes a series. Maybe that has legs. But
that,
I think
Star
Fox Adventures,
well.
It did well for what it was, but then I think Assault following it didn't do as hot. But that was also just because of the state of the GameCube at the time.
Yep. Well, and like I said, Assault, the lead up to Assault, press wasn't good on it. Like, people wound up being okay with it, but Adventures reviewed, I think it's fantastic, but Adventures reviewed better and sold. I mean, it was one of the, I think it's like the 11th best selling GameCube. It's like just outside the top 10. But yeah, no, as far as GameCube games go, once it's like the Metroid thing, as far as GameCube games go, Star Fox Adventures did very well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the game still looks great visually.
Oh, it's insane visually.
Yeah, I think the gameplay is not aged particularly well, but also, like, I enjoyed it when I played it back in the day.
I think it aged exactly as well as Ocarina of Time. And I say that to you knowing your opinions on Ocarina of Time.
You know where I'm at.
Like that.
I mean, I also think that Ocarina of Time was better back in 1998 compared to what Star Fox Adventures was in 2002. But yeah, I'll agree with that statement.
Yeah. Well, Star Fox Adventures is ultimately a Nintendo 64 game. So it kind of feels like Ocarina of Time. Like, that's, its game design is from pretty much the same era as Ocarina of Time. Like, it's a contemporary to Majora's Mask that just got delayed onto the GameCube, and they spent all that time making it pretty.
Yeah, and there's stuff here, like Doshin the Giant was here, and I don't know if you noticed the thing that I, the news story about how three new GameCube games plus Doshin for US, the news story in Nintendo Report. Param's quirky god game, Doshin the Giant. There were rumors that the Japanese version of the game would include English language options, and that turned out to be unfounded. Shortly thereafter, Giles Goddard was kind enough to stop by our talkback to let us know that an English version was underway, though there had been no official confirmation of a North American release. I love Giles.
We should reach out to him and be like, what the fuck?
Yeah, what happened to Doshin?
Yeah, excuse me, sir.
But yeah, it was listed as a game in development. So was Gift Pia, which that's a skip game, kind of a precursor to Captain Rainbow. Which you can watch our own Xander Morningstar play over on the Twitch channel. He's playing through the English translation version, which Captain Rainbow rules. I've never played Gift Pia, would love to. Stage debut was also shown off, and then that never really came about. I mean, it really was an impressive list of games. Like, you look at everything that Nintendo had at the show. Like, I mean, it was a really good lineup. A lot of variety. Even Pokemon, Wario World, good GBA stuff.
Yeah, Golden Sun, The Lost Age was on there.
There was a game called Donkey Kong Plus that I think that just turned into like whatever the non-March of the Minis game was.
The like Jungle Climber?
No, there was one that was more like DK94 on GBA.
Oh, just Mario versus Donkey Kong.
Yeah.
That's an incredible game.
It is a very good game. But anyway, that's Nintendo's E3 in 2002.
It was a great one.
Yeah, I thought it was a very good E3.
Like we said, you can watch their entire press conference on our YouTube channel. We were, I guess, some of the few people there who had nice cameras and filmed it pretty well.
Yeah.
So
that's also where the immortal Miyamoto saying, "I love Planet GameCube," comes from.
Yes, because in 2002, I guess, after the end of a press conference, you could just like walk over to Miyamoto, who is like sitting by the side of a stage, probably having a smoke or something, and just walk up to him and be like, "Hi, would you say something into our camera?" And he'd be like, "Yeah, that seems cool." Whereas like now, he's like ushered out of the building by security guards and you would get tackled. Also, there wouldn't be a press conference for you to approach him at. But
yeah, no, it is weird. And I think I don't know. Let us know. Write in with your thoughts of E3 2002 or E3 2007 and 2012. We aspire to do more E3 lookbacks in the weeks leading up to what would have been E3 2022.
Let's do all of them. And then in the week, if Nintendo doesn't do anything, we'll just do an imaginary episode on like what we think they might have done. It's like a prediction episode, but where we can't be wrong because it never actually happens.
I'm very excited to get to E3 2012 because if you look at that year, you're just like, oh, that's when I stopped doing them live.
Yeah.
Like everything goes wrong in E3 2012. And they're like, fuck you. We're just doing pre-recorded videos.
Yeah.
And guess what? It was prophetic. It was brilliant. Like everybody was like, Nintendo's skipping E3. And like, okay, the only reason why it was bad is because the Wii U was hemorrhaging blood But like in the long haul, like, no, that was brilliant. You reached out to your audiences directly.
And now PlayStation and Xbox are struggling to figure out how to do it.
Yeah, Xbox is going to have like another day and a half of streams with people you've never heard of doing commercials.
Yeah, Xbox does not get it.
Anyway, that's an episode of Connectivity. We'll be back here next week with more things. I hope you like it. And let us know if you want to, any topics, any questions, any reflections of past E3s, send those over to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. You can hit us up on Twitter @ConnectivityNWR.
Send in your hot Dante's Inferno takes. Yeah. There is a tutorial message in Dante's Inferno, I forgot to mention this, that says, use stylish combos to fill up your redemption meter, which might be one of the best sentences in a video game. That's my final thought on Dante's Inferno.
And also, if you're listening to this and you got a play date, let me know what you think. And if there's any games out on itch that I should get, because I'm definitely itching to find more play date games. All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
This was made possible by our generous supporters on Patreon. Check out patreon.com/NWR for all the details.